The committee will come to order. We don't have a quorum yet, but we will begin today with House File 420. If Representative Neal would come forward. When we get the chance, the bill will be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Higher Education Policy and Finance when a quorum is present. So, Representative O'Neill, if you could please start by introducing your bill.
Yes. Thank you, Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I actually have two bills up. I'm really excited to be in front of your committee. And I have to say, I'm really excited because my brother's on this committee. So this is the first time that I've been on in front of a committee that my brother was on it, and I didn't share the committee with him, so this is pretty exciting. So my bill today is actually a section of House File 1, and it is a tax credit. So this is an allowable refund tax income credit for individuals who take jobs after June 30th in fields of STEM or long-term care. And so I have a couple long-term care people here that will speak to specifically the need in long-term care, as you probably have heard many times over. Specifically, what this does as far as a tax credit is, it's specific to regions that have a job vacancy rate of about 10% over the vacancy rate, the average of the vacancy rate of the state. The credit equals 50% of the state grant allowance for tuition and fees for two-year or four-year programs in the state of Minnesota if you obtain your degree in those areas. The maximum credit is $5,000 for individuals for a four-year degree and $2,500 for individuals with a two-year degree. The $5,000 is for a four-year degree, the $2,500 is for the two-year degree. And individuals may claim the tax credit in the year that they gain employment, and they can do that for the next 4 years. So we're really hoping that this will help bring more people into the area, especially of long-term care. And so with that, I'll turn it over to my two testifiers to talk about the long-term care and more specifically about the bill.
Okay, please introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Carrie Thurlow here with Leading Age Minnesota and also here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I don't think it would be a Wednesday morning if I wasn't here before you. So thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 420. We want to thank Representative O'Neill for bringing this forward. I know this committee has spent a lot of time hearing about and talking about the caregiving workforce shortage that we have throughout Minnesota and the impacts that has on senior care providers. Just as a reminder, one quick statistic. We estimate that there are over 1,800 vacant open positions unfilled just in nursing homes alone. And this particular bill would be one of those tools to help build the pipeline to get more people into caregiving careers and help to address our shortage. We have a shortage today, but we know we're going to have an even bigger shortage in the future if we don't start to build that pipeline. And so this bill helps to address that and are very supportive of it.
Mr. Chair, members, Toby Pearson, Care Providers in Minnesota, also with the Long-Term Care Imperative today. As Ms. Thurlow mentioned, we're going to have more demand for services and we have a higher need for quality caregivers, and this bill will hopefully help address that in the long term. As Ms. Thurlow also mentioned, that we have a number of vacancies within all of the nursing homes across the state, but probably the more astonishing fact is that we had over 1,500 nursing home admissions that were denied just for the fact that we didn't have the staff to accept to admit the people. So there's a dire need out there, both urgent now as well as in the future, to start caring for the increased demand for our services. So that's why we support the House file. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And we do have a quorum, so I will officially call the meeting to order. And just quickly, Representative Tice will move the minutes from March 4th. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to the March 4th minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted. And Representative Daniels, would you like to move your sister's bill here?
I would like to move my sister's bill to... to somewhere. I didn't see where it was going.
It's you're moving the House File 420 to be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Higher Education Policy and Finance.
I so move.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on the bill in the audience? Okay, seeing none. Are there questions from members? Representative Newton.
Mr. Chair, if I can ask a question of the testifiers, and this is somewhat unrelated, but In our last meeting of the Veterans Affairs Committee, there have been presentations by Montevideo and Bemidji to build veterans homes. And one of my concerns has been that we already have space in existing homes, and whether or not that's a wise thing to be doing, to be building them, you know, throughout the state. And maybe this isn't the right forum for it, but I think the discussion has to be had, because we're also looking at Preston, Wilmer, Brainerd, several other communities, Rochester, who have indicated that they also would like to have veterans homes with capacities of 60 to 100 patients per. So is that something that can be addressed here, or something that should be perhaps better dealt with in the Veterans Affairs Committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think you posed a couple different questions within that question, and we'd love to talk with you more at length about it, because there are a number of different layers to that question that we'd be happy to sit down and talk with you about.
Super. I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right. Any other questions on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Daniels renews his motion then that House File 420 be recommended to be re-referred to the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and House File 420 is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Higher Education Policy and Finance. Representative Daniels, would you like to move your sister's next bill?
Yes.
This will be going to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance.
Well, you know, we had a little argument last night, so I'm not. Oh, I'm just kidding. Yes, I also moved to 562 bill 562 be moved to
Health and Human Service.
Health
Finance.
And Human Services. Thank you.
All right.
I'm not awake yet.
We have the bill before us, Representative O'Neill, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. This bill is incredibly important to me. This is a bill specifically for the county where I represent. And when we are in interim, I do a lot of things, as you do as well, I'm sure. And one of my favorite things to do is actually go and tour places. And so I actually toured both of these nursing homes that are in Buffalo, right in my district, in the heart of my district. And they told me a story that I'm sure you've heard many, many times over, but I'm going to have them come and tell it. Actually, I've got a whole group of people from Wright County right behind me. If they would just sort of raise their hand to show you how many people are here from Wright County. Basically, everyone sitting behind me are here in support of this bill. And the reason is because the rate for the nursing homes in Wright County is substantially less than the rates of all of the counties around us. And if you pull this up, it shows you very clearly the yellow is where Wright County is, and all of the red are all of the counties around us that have a much higher rate. And they're going to tell us exactly what that does to these poor nursing homes in Wright County. So I can't tell you how imperative this is, how the need is so dire, and this bill addresses that. And this would bring the rate up to the rates that are similar around us. And so I'd really like for your support, and I'm going to turn over to the testifier so that they can tell you exactly what's happening out in Wright County.
All right. Please introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jason Nelson. I'm the administrator of Lake Ridge Care Center in Buffalo. And I am here to testify on HF 562, the rate increase for facilities in Wright County. You should all have a handout, and I'm just going to do a cursory walkthrough just to kind of clarify or look at and talk about the information that I have in the handout. Wright County is classified as a metro county for a number of different organizations, including the federal government. Shows a little picture on the second page with a nice red arrow going towards the county of Wright County. On the next page is the map that Representative O'Neill had indicated. You can see the black arrow going towards Wright County. In 2006, Stearns, Benton, and Sherburne counties were designated into the metro rate, established on rates that were defined in 1985. In 2015, we find Wright County surrounded by other metro counties, and we're looking to have our rates in the metro rate as well and not in rural any longer. On the next slide, we are unable to keep our nursing employees because they are able to go to the other counties surrounding us, immediately surrounding us. This slide indicates the move to the metro area from the rural designation, and you can see that Wright County is included in that as well. And how is Wright County ranked to other counties in the state of Minnesota? The next four slides have the determinations by population, population density, median household income, and per capita income. And all of the counties that you see on here are all counties designated as metro Wright counties. And you can see that Wright County is represented in the top 10 of all four of those categories. And that's not only out of these counties, that is out of the state. But I just wanted to show you an illustration of that as well.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Ann Dirks. I'm the administrator at Parkview Care Center in Buffalo. And I'd like to tell you what effect this has on us when our nursing home is surrounded on three sides by counties that have the metro rate. It means that they have a much higher reimbursement rate coming into their facility than we do. And our biggest expense at any of our nursing homes is our staff. It's our best asset, but it's also our biggest expense. And when we can't compete with wages, our staff are able to go a few miles down the road, cross the county line, and receive a metro rate salary. We spend a lot of time training our staff. We have high quality staff. And the staff that you have in a nursing home basically determines the quality of that nursing home. So to have the turnover of our staff leaving is hard on our quality, and it's very hard on our residents. The residents become familiar with their caregivers. They develop relationships. They determine their routines. They get to know the routines. And then, because of economic reasons, that caregiver needs to take a job that pays better, and the residents are devastated. They come to my office and they say, why is so-and-so leaving? Why can't you pay her more money so that she'll stay here? And we just can't afford to do that. And so what happens is the residents actually take the brunt of it, and they have to start basically training the new staff again to their routines and so that they have a good quality of life.
All right, thank you, Ms. Dirks. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Not seeing anybody. Are there questions from members on House File 562? Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Daniels, I'm glad you got the opportunity to move your sister's bill. When my brother was down here, I didn't really want to move. Well, I sort of wanted to move his bills, but it was a little different. So I'm glad you're having perhaps more fun than I did. Just more of my comments are just, I just, you know, we continue to hear these bills, and I hate to peck at the side, but I think just big picture, we should really be, continuing to really do a good package and do a good bill. The last lady's testimony was just, again, so powerful, and just to, again, it's the pay, and then the reason why the pay is so important, she got into the turnover, and then, the training, the retraining that employers need to do, and then the failure to be able to do quality care because there's, Helen, remember Helen? I don't know if I forgot her picture today, but Helen, just to make sure, that Helen doesn't serve broccoli when she doesn't like broccoli or whatever the case may be. But so anyways, I just thank you for coming forward, and not that I'm against your bill, it's just big picture, we just really need to, we all have these stories, and I continue to be concerned that we're, each doing them. So, and maybe as a member, I'm failing because I better get out of my nursing homes and make sure that their needs are individually. I was kind of thinking big picture state, so I better get on my selfish hat a little bit, and maybe it's too late with the hearings. But thank you. So,
thank you, Representative Lilly. Representative Considine.
First of all, I love Wright County. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But again, the same thing that I brought up last time, and Representative Lilly, I'm very supportive of your bill because it takes care of the entire state. If we pass this, then next week it's going to be Meeker and McLeod because they're right up against Wright County. They will now have the same problem of retaining staff. Last time we heard these bills, I believe in Princeton, it was 600 feet they were from the county line. We need to have a comprehensive plan to take care of this. And Sheriff Schumacher, your bill does that, and I continue to be supportive of that. And it's this again, it's just piecemeal this way, and every single county that we've heard from have had extenuating circumstances. And I don't doubt for a minute that they're all true. It's just that we're not fixing the overall problem. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Considine. Representative Gunther, did you have something to that point?
And just out of curiosity, what's the difference between the metro rate and the rate you get?
It's about 17% difference.
17, wow.
Thank you, Mr. Erks. Okay. Wow. Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And Olmsted County is going to be one of those, Representative Considine, because I just got a bill drafted for Olmsted County. And if I'm too late for the bill deadline, I'll be offering it as an amendment as some of these go through. And I hope that you all will support that, because we are all in this situation. And it's just as bad for one as for the other. And just to tell you about Olmsted County, my nursing homes have to compete with Mayo Clinic for staff. You know, we heard a bill about a veterans facility that has to compete. Some are next to a higher rate area, on and on and on. So we've all got that same issue. It's really a compelling issue, and the only way to really deal with it is something like the chair's bill. So I sure hope to see that funded in the budget, Mr. Chair. And if it isn't, I think you're going to have a lot of members complaining. But I sure hope we're not going to pick winners and losers here, because the system already picks winners and losers, as we see. I'm not sure we're picking any winners, to tell you the truth. Even the higher rates aren't, you know, nobody's rolling in dough in the state. I don't know, maybe some are. But I think most nursing homes in the state are, I think it's safe to say, not rolling in dough. People are really struggling to provide very essential services, and we need to do something about it as a state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask what Representative Gunther asked, but I wanted to say I'm really thrilled to hear the conversation here, because we're going to have a lot of support for House File 316, the chairman's bill, right?
Let's hope. Okay, any other questions for the testifiers on House Files 562? Seeing none, Representative Daniels renews his motion that House File 562 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and House File 562 is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Next, members, we're going to move up the agenda just a little bit to accommodate some of the testifiers. Representative Norton, so we're going to welcome Representative Norton to the committee with House File 1056, and I will move House File 1056 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. We have the bill before us. Representative Norton, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My testifiers are on their way down here. And I will start and talk about this bill. And this is a bill that will create a grant program for the development and support of Lifesaver Rapid Response Programs. It's a grant program with voluntary participation for training and associated equipment so that all counties and jurisdictions have access to a Project Lifesaver opportunity for their populations at risk. Currently, 26 counties in the state of Minnesota and 22 agencies for a total of 48 different opportunities exist. And I'm just going to tell you a little bit about the program, and then we'll let our testifiers, who's been a champion for this particular project all along, tell you a little bit more. The bracelet is purchased by the family of the elderly or disabled or at-risk individual. And they provide that support, but this bill is training for the law enforcement officers who need to learn to use the equipment and be able to support the families whose individual may wander off and get lost. And I think Mr. Trahan will give you some real-life examples. He's been on a couple of these fines around the country, and he can tell you how it works and how important it is. We're looking at about $6,000 roughly, and we have an open appropriation on this, as you'll see, per entity that needs training. And so it's really a scalable bill, and that's really what I'm hoping to I know you're dealing with policy today, but trying to explain to you that this could, we could fund a large grant, and I'm estimating $350,000 to $400,000 if every single county in every single, you know, across the state wanted this. That isn't going to be the case. We can do it scalable, and it's just, it would just be first come, first serve for those counties that are interested, because we don't want to force something upon a county or a law enforcement agency or an area that doesn't want it. This would be just for those who do. And I think Brad, I'll let Brad testify a little bit and tell you he's worked extensively with our local agencies across the state and, in fact, across the country, because, as Brad will probably tell you, programs like this exist. As our elderly population moves up and as Alzheimer's increases, we are going to have a need, and this doesn't replace staff, it doesn't replace family watching these individuals, but when they do wander off, this is a real opportunity to make certain that person is returned safely and quickly to their place of residence and with the families and people that care and love them. So with that, Mr. Chair, this is Brad Trahan. He lives in Rochester, and he and his son are here to share a little bit more.
Thank you, Representative Norton. Mr. Trahan, please introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, members of the committee. Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for the accommodation to move up a little bit. If I lose a little eye contact, I apologize. I'm going to work with Reese here a little bit. Brad Trahan, 2570 Clean Street, Northeastern Rochester, Minnesota. Appreciate this legislation being heard. It's near and dear to my heart. Reese has severe autism, but it's important to know on this legislation, it's just not for individuals with autism. It could be dementia, it could be Alzheimer's, it could be Down syndrome. We have 5 million Americans that are estimated to be having Alzheimer's, and 60% of those members with Alzheimer's will wander. So the bottom line is, in 2007, I was on a search in Wisconsin. A little boy named Benji Heil went missing on a Friday night, 7 years old, with autism. And I just had to go over there. It was close by. And long story short on that Tuesday morning after going on a search on a Monday, the command post was unbelievable with everyone being set up. I'm sure if you work with law enforcement, you see what it takes to find a missing individual. It's pretty intense. You have to count for your volunteers. You have to count to make sure everyone's okay. We came back from our search on Monday, and a veteran police officer called everyone together on a Tuesday, He called everyone together Tuesday. And found out that Benji was found dead in a pond just south of his home, roughly about 200 miles. And I went back to Benji's funeral that same Saturday. And I'll never forget, my friends, the weeping that I heard from that family, the friends, the volunteers, the strangers. Now, I just vowed I never ever want to see a mom and dad kiss their child's casket and say goodbye to their child, knowing that he's in a better place. Just a couple days after that happened, we had one in Minnesota where a girl with autism was found dead. Into water. It's a death trap for kids with autism. I want to, for full transparency, I am on the board of directors for Project Lifesaver International based out of Virginia, but there's many other fine technology agencies that are doing this type of work to find individuals. I can't imagine. What we did is we started Project Lifesaver in Olmsted County in 2007. We have roughly about 70 to 80 clients on it, and in 2009, I got a call from a police officer, and he wanted to meet. We had our first find in Rochester, Minnesota. A girl darted from her mother, and mom was convinced that the girl went that direction. When the police were called and they activated the team, they started bringing out their equipment. And Project Life, in our case, it's basically handheld equipment, but they can also be en route via their squads and have an antenna on their squad. And they start picking up a signal from these individuals. I'll show you what Reese is wearing. This is the type of bracelet it is. Inside this bracelet, each individual has a frequency assigned to it. So when the call out goes out, a 911 call goes out, dispatch is already putting their frequency in, and they're sending that into the response team. So when they respond to this call, while mom thought the child was that way, where they found the child was the opposite direction and near a riverbed. The average length of time they're finding these individuals is 30 minutes or less. The Project Lifesaver that I'm on, we've had over 2,000 searches since 1999, no fatalities, and it's 30 minutes or less. I get reports daily, or weekly, I should mention, that the number of instances where people are wanting off, it's dementia, Alzheimer's, autism, it's amazing. Think about the elements of some of these individuals. Some of these individuals, when they're out into the winter months, cold doesn't bother them. And they just have hours to live. We're very excited for the fact of this legislation going forward. We started it in 2009 with former Representative Welty. We had some good success in the House. We stalled in the Senate. But I wanted to revisit it because we have so much going on. We have so many vulnerable individuals. And I can't imagine if we have tools and technology in this day and age to help our public safety, law enforcement, or fire to locate these individuals much quicker and faster, that's the best case scenario. Bruce Kennedy, a father of Keith Kennedy, a Minnesota man, back in 2008, went over to a camp in Wisconsin. Keith was missing for 7 days. They had thousands of searchers, horseback, dogs, helicopters looking for Keith. And as Bruce testified back then, they were literally going to come up to him and tell him the search is done. They found Keith at basically what they quote as the 11th hour. Keith also had underlying kidney conditions that needed more medication. And a physician reported that he just thought Keith was maybe hours from dying. And what's good about this technology, friends, they can track these individuals up to 1 mile to 2 miles on the ground and 10 to 20 miles in the air. They figure Keith probably would have been found in no more than an hour's time. He was no more further than 1 mile from the camp that he left. I spoke out in North Dakota on a Department of Human Services. They received a grant for autism and talked to them about this as well. I'm happy to announce that Walsh County in North Dakota is our first team. We're getting them signed up. And I just reported we were working with the Fargo Police Department and Grand Forks Police Department. We're working on getting them going too. It's just a passion, my friends. I just know that there's technology out there. And I can't imagine a parent missing their child, mainstreamed or whatnot, and vulnerable. But for Reese or his peers, or if my parents one day come down with dementia or Alzheimer's and they went missing, the anxiety, the fear that goes through, and if we can just make it simpler and bring these loved ones home alive, that's all this bill is about. It's just giving agencies an opportunity to help them.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Trahan. I believe we had a couple of questions for you from members. Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you for bringing this bill. My brother does search and rescue, and those are not searches they want to go on. So this would be very much appreciated there. And we have a friend who has a son who has autism, and he got lost in a Nebraska cornfield. And it took, like, the whole town had to turn out to find him. He's 4 years old, so there's really a need. My question, I see that the use of the grant is for the infrastructure for the searchers. What's the cost to the individual, to the family, for, you know, startup, and is there service costs ongoing and batteries and whatnot?
Chair Schumacher, Representative Russo, thank you for your comments. The startup, it could vary from agency to agency, but our typical startup, from my experience, is the first year cost to a individual is $350. It's about $25 a month. And then the year after, it's about $150 for the next year. And what that year after does is these batteries have to get changed out. They're ready for about 45 days, but we change the batteries out about every 30 days. Now, I also want to make sure, let's not confuse this with GPS. GPS is what it kind of gets referred to. This is radio frequency. This penetrates water. It penetrates subways. It penetrates skyways. If Reese drowned one day and he couldn't be found, this will penetrate up to 8 feet of water. At least it brings closure to families sooner rather than seasons later. And I can say the consumer support grants that some of these individuals are on do recognize this, and they pay that fee. Does that answer your question?
Yarusso.
That part. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then are these proprietary systems, or can the locating equipment be used with, are there different brands and whatnot?
Chair Schumacher, Representative
Mr. Russo. Trahan.
Sorry. There are different technologies out there. Will they interface with one another? I doubt that. What we're trying to seek to do is appropriate some funding for local agencies to select what technology would be the best fit for their agency. I do know, with regards to, as you've seen the map, with regards to Project Lifesaver, we're in 26 counties, and there's an additional 22 agencies supporting that. And they do interface with LoJack Company.
Representative Kirsten. Okay, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, after I raised my hand, the testifier answered my question. I was wondering kind of how long it had been, and you mentioned 2009. That's 6 years. Probably need to get this done. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a very quick comment. Representative Norton, thank you very much. This is a great bill. I appreciate you coming here. And it's Reese, correct?
Yes, sir.
Reese? I want to thank Reese for coming and testifying also as well. I have a son with, we say, low-functioning autism. So, and I see you taking care of him, and I appreciate you doing that, so thank you.
Okay, are there any other questions for this testifier? Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norton, I noticed that there isn't a note for the how much it would cost. Are you planning a fiscal note? Is this a requirement for all counties? I mean, not a requirement, but an option for all counties. You know, where? What are you thinking?
Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keel. Well, at this point, we've left it open. It could be. It is scalable. So if we want to put, say, $350,000, we probably could do anyone in the entire state that wanted it, every county and jurisdiction. If we want to just have a grant system that's first come, first serve, we could put, say, $100,000 in there and do it this year and come back again in another year if there's a need, more requests than we funded. You know, not everyone will want to do this, and we understand that. So it is scalable. And at this time, we've left it open. You know, I'm certainly willing to put a number in there, and at some point I probably will have to, but it is flexible, and that's the point I wanted to make here at the beginning.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it just escaped me. So the counties, it would just be an option for them. How much cost would this be to keep upkeep on this, or is it just a one-time cost for counties? I'm guessing there's got to be some upgrade.
Representative Norton.
Yep. Mr. Trahan. Representative Keel. Typically, I can be honest with you, the many law enforcement agencies I've worked with across Minnesota and you know, and talked to in North Dakota, they actually train quarterly, and they feel that when they're bringing a tool like this to them, it's worth them to keep up on their training, similar to hostage negotiation, similar to ERU response team. They feel that when they have tools like this, they continue their quarterly training. So quite honestly, when we started Project Lifesaver at Olmsted County in Rochester, Minnesota, we got a member of about 18 police officers. Now there's a waiting list for people that are applying to get on for when we have openings. So it's ongoing departmental training that they just take in-house.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just part of my district, East Grand Forks, I know, has the Lifesaver program, and partly I believe because there was a child lost,
yes.
And that was the response there. But I know it really works. My grandmother used to know how to escape the alarm system from the nursing home, mm-hmm. and we would find her outside often. Fortunately, she lived a block away, so she'd end up at her house, and the neighbors would call the nursing home and say, she's trying to get in her house again. So anyway, I understand how important it is. So,
thank you, Representative Keel. Are there any other questions for this testifier? Okay, seeing none. Mr. Trahan and Reese, thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Please come forward, state your name for the record, and please give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Jonah Weinberg, I'm the Executive Director at the Autism Society of Minnesota, and I simply wanted to voice our support for this bill. This is a very important issue, and for families who have a child that wanders, Mr. Trahan shared, it can be an extremely harrowing and tragic event. For children with autism, very often, it's not just the issue of them wandering off and being a person wandering about in an unknown area. If that child becomes scared, they're most likely to find the tiniest, smallest place and curl themselves up into a little ball and stay there, which is going to make it even harder for law enforcement or volunteers to help find them. And as much as we want to be thoughtful about the availability of this, I do know that Project Lifesaver is one of the more respected programs across the nation. The Autism Society of Minnesota is a sister affiliate to 102 different autism societies across the U.S., and I know that this is the predominant system that is used by law enforcement agencies with regard to this issue. And lastly, I just wanted to also share that with regard to the cost, and we always want to be fiscally mindful of the public dollars, the use of public dollars, but the cost of one search event for a lost or missing person could more than pay for what is being considered for appropriation, although I understand nothing has been put forward on paper. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Weinberg. Any questions for this testifier? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Thank you, Mr. Weinberg. Seeing none, are there any final questions for Representative Norton? Oh, okay. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Norton. I want to thank you, too, and we've been hearing a lot about children with autism, but this is aging and long-term care, and so I do want to share that a good friend of mine's father was experienced dementia and Alzheimer's, and he was still at home, and his wife was trying to keep him at home as long as possible. But when he started wandering, that's when she really had to make decisions. And she could take quick trips down and, you know, pick up mail and, you know, go buy a few groceries. And, of course, some days he started wandering. And so she would get the phone call from the neighbors, hey, Bill was out wandering around again. He's at our house. And so to put it back to aging and long-term care, yes, it happens. And I'm very pleased that you're bringing this forward because folks want to keep them home as long as they can, and as long as they're willing to do the work, I think it's a good way to keep them home. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other final questions? Okay. Representative Norton, final word.
And I was going to bring it back. Thank you very much for doing that. We need to remember, while 1 in 68 children right now are being diagnosed with autism, they will all age. And they will be part of our long-term care population, as are elderly. And my grandmother, who lived to be 103 just a few years ago, she died, and she was living in an assisted living facility. And that's when we realized that she had faltered, because she took a walk in a neighborhood, and they found her curled up, hiding under bushes, because she was so embarrassed she didn't know how to get home. And that was the time when we decided it was time for her to move from the assisted living into a more protected environment. And so I share, you know, those feelings, those concerns. It's heart-wrenching, and we're having a large and growing older population who this may save. So I'm very happy to bring it forward, and I thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Representative Norton. With that, I renew my motion that House File 1056 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and House File 1056 is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy.
Thank you,
Representative Norton. Okay, next we'll take up House File 1152, Representative Daniels. And Representative Daniels is going to be moving that House File 1152 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. Is that your motion, Representative Daniels?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Daniels makes that motion. We have the bill before us. There is an author's amendment titled DE1. Representative Daniels moves the DE1 amendment. Representative Daniels, to the amendment.
Yes, the amendment, basically we had some prior ideas on presenting a bill that would allow some of the nursing facilities to stock some of the vaccines that they need to administer, and we decided to do away with that at this time and pretty much turn this into more of a study, so we get more input from more agencies and more people that are involved in the care. And so we would like to strike that language and then present the bill in the current format.
Okay, is there any testimony on this amendment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Carrie Thurlow with Leading Age Minnesota. We're happy to talk about the amendment now, or if you want to, we can walk through it if you'd like, whatever the chair's desires, or we can talk about the bill as amendment, however you want to.
Are there questions to this amendment before we adopt it to get it in the form that Representative Daniels wants it? Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, I don't claim to be an over-expert on vaccines, but I was a little concerned, so I'm glad to see that they're pulling this part of storage was a concern of mine, so I'm glad, because that sounded a little scary, so I'm glad you're backing off on that a little. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Any other questions to this amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting the DE1 amendment, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Daniels, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill actually is going to see if we can do some study research to see if we can actually help the local senior care facilities basically save money, be more streamlined in what they provide for the vaccines. So we've got a number of agencies that we'd like to be in a study group. They're listed starting on 1.24, starts with the Commissioner of Health, the Commissioner of Human Services, representative by the Minnesota Board of Nursing, and so on. It's quite lengthy. We've got a good background of different agencies and people in the industry that would give input to see if we can actually save a little money for the nursing facilities. I understand, I might turn it over to Carrie. She knows a little bit more about it than I do as far as with the issues that the nursing homes are having in detail. But it's basically to see if we can get a study going and if they would recommend or see fit to allow some of the nursing facilities to have some of these vaccines on hand and maybe a longer, a higher number so that they're not running back and forth and placing orders more frequently. Just to try to streamline it, cost saving, time saving. Well, with that, I'm going to turn it over to Carrie. She's got all the facts and figures.
Thank you, Representative Daniels. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first we want to thank Representative Daniels for bringing this forward. This really has to do with home care agencies and vaccinating their employees for some required vaccinations, primarily the hepatitis B vaccine, influenza, and TB vaccine. A lot of our licensed home care agencies are very small. We have a very mobile workforce within, and very much it's somewhat of a challenge to access vaccines. A lot of them don't have medical directors on staff, so it's not as easy as, for example, vaccinating healthcare staff in a hospital where you have a medical director and doctors on staff that can sort of write the prescriptions and obtain the vaccines. And so this was brought forward to us by a number of our small home care agencies that are having difficulty both with the expense and the access of vaccines. We know that there's a lot of discussion around this. We know that there's we need to maintain protections and safeguards, but also want to make it easier and more cost-effective for these home care agencies to be able to vaccinate their staff in a timely way. So you can see we've identified a number of options to consider. We want to bring all of the stakeholders together to talk about it and then proceed logically perhaps next year with whatever recommendations come out of that group.
Okay. Any other testimony from the two of you?
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Erin Bowie from Care Providers of Minnesota here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I just want to also thank Representative Daniels for bringing this bill forward. We're hopeful that this working group can come up with some solutions to make these required screenings and vaccinations more accessible to our home care agency employees.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Well, certainly it's a great goal. I mean, I think the goal of increasing immunization rates all over the state is super important. And it's kind of a hot topic right now, as a matter of fact, on a number of fronts. I'm sure you know that. But really, one of the questions I have is, don't pharmacists have the ability to vaccinate people? And I would think that there would be a way to just have a pharmacist come into these small facilities and vaccinate people would be one thing. But the other thing I just wanted to ask about sort of the direction this bill is going, do you really need to have a legislated working group to address this issue? I mean, can't people just sit down and talk to each other and say, gee, we've got a problem here. How can we problem solve around this? That would, it would seem to be the easier, cheaper solution. Why aren't you doing that?
Ms. Thurl?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I think there were a couple of questions there. I'm certainly not expert on what pharmacists can and can't do, but again, these aren't necessarily facilities we're talking about. These are home care agencies where the staff are not necessarily all in one facility where it's just easy to dispense and sort of vaccinate at one time. That's one of the challenges that we have here, and they tend to be very small agencies, small staff. So certainly it's an option that we're willing to talk about, you know, in looking at that. As to, you know, the question, do we need a legislatively mandated group? I think it's a fair question. I think what you'll see here from the variety of stakeholders is there's a lot of cross-section, interagency cross-section between health, human services, and then also various licensing boards. And as you can imagine, all of these groups and stakeholders, there's a lot of issues out there. And without some sort of potential direction out there to sort of move this on a particular timeline, getting all of those folks together in a room on a timely basis is sometimes challenging. That's not to say we don't have good working relationships with everyone, but in order to sort of move this with possible action next year, we think that it would be an important step forward.
Follow-up, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, the more I think about this, I mean, there are so many little issues and problems that pop up. And, you know, we heard a bill in one of the other HHS committees the other day. I forget now if it was policy or finance. I get them all mixed up in my mind. But it was the lobbyist for that was Kevin Goodnow. And, you know, after some questions, it became clear that he had really done his homework. And he had talked to all the players, and he had, and it had to do with dispensing over-the-counter drugs in, I think it was Representative Loehmer's bill, right? Representative Francis nodded her head. And when I asked some questions about it, it became clear that he had done his homework and talked to all the players and got everything lined up, and he was solving a problem. And I get that this is a different problem, it's more disseminated, it's a different issue, but I don't really see why we should appropriate funds to have people go and talk to all the players who might be involved in this. It seems like this is the, you know, an issue that you, the association that represents these people, could be helping them solve without doing it through an appropriation and a legislatively mandated task force. And there certainly are times when, or working group rather, and, you know, certainly working groups have a really important place, and they have sometimes been really necessary to kind of bring groups together and put a spotlight on things. But boy, I'm just not convinced that we need to do that in this instance when I guess I'd like to hear a little bit more about what work you've done to try to solve this problem up to this point, so that I would be convinced that it's necessary to appropriate state funds, taxpayer funds, to facilitate this process, that it's got to the point where it really can't be solved any other way. As much as I support the underlying principle that everyone should be vaccinated.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. And since the department did help with the DE-1 amendment, I was hoping that they could come up and maybe help facilitate on where the discussion's been going to.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members. Dan Pollack, Deputy Commissioner from the Department of Health. And I brought a friend.
Chris Ayersman, Director for Infectious Disease at the Minnesota Department of Health.
And Chris can give some background about the work that they've done already. I just want to say up front that Representative Daniels and the industry groups have been very flexible on the language. They basically worked with us on this delete all as technical assistance. Really appreciate the opportunity to kind of give some feedback. And if you look at the delete all compared to the original bill, what we were really looking for were the opportunity to have a discussion of multiple options. The original bill really is focused on putting the stockpiles in the home care agencies, and we wanted to look at a couple different possibilities, including doing nothing, and whether that would be workable and, you know, continue to protect the public. Obviously, this is a serious issue. Obviously, it's one we take seriously, and this part of our agency takes seriously. So Chris will talk a little bit more about the work they've already done.
Okay. Thank you. In October of 2012, some industry representatives approached the Department of Health with their concerns related to long-term care facilities obtaining tuberculin to be able to do the necessary TB testing of staff, as well as the ability to obtain vaccines so that they could vaccinate staff. And so we had a meeting with them, heard what their concerns were, and you know, they wanted, as the original bill had said, they wanted the ability to hold and store these things, as well as the ability to be able to administer vaccines in the absence of a medical director. And so, you know, there are a couple of statutes that make that challenging. First of all, right now, Legend drugs, which vaccines and tuberculin would fall under, can need to be in the possession or, you know, under the license of a licensed practitioner, which would include a physician, dentist, optometrist, podiatrist, veterinarian, advanced practice nurse. So the challenge was, in these situations without a medical director, they did not have the ability to hold these Legend drugs. Then another challenge is that the Wholesale Drug Distribution Licensing Act would mean that pharmacies that didn't have a wholesale distributor license couldn't actually distribute legally to these entities. So there, you know, there are a number of statutes in place that would be challenging to them, and so they had asked us if there was a way that we could help them out. Well, you know, our concern is that the current statutes have a health and safety role to make sure that things are handled appropriately, that storage and handling is correct, that administration is correct, all of those things. And so what we did at the time was we put together a number of things, protocols that could be used, so that if you did have a medical director, that they could use a protocol that we helped put together for the administration of tuberculin. We put a number of things on our website, and, you know, we got back together with the group and offered some of these educational and other helps. But the challenge is that for the industry, that was not sufficient, and so they still felt that they had concerns, and so they wanted to pursue this. And I guess our goal in participating with the amendment was ensuring that there was a full discussion of the various issues, then that it was fully vetted as the different options were considered. But we did, as I said, we met with the industry representatives twice, both once to hear their concerns and then the second time to present the work that we had done and the materials that we put together. And as I said, they didn't feel it was sufficient to meet their needs, and so that's why we're working on this now.
Representative Liebling, did that get to your question?
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And, you know, it explains to me why we're sitting here with a bill that has a working group instead of a mandated solution. I'm still not sure. You know, so often around here, we sort of punt by creating some kind of study group. And so I'm kind of seeing that that's what we're doing here. And I still kind of think, though, that the preferred solution would probably be to just work on it for another session without spending public funds to do that. I don't know how much money Representative Dean is going to have in his target, but I certainly think that this doesn't depend on that. And, you know, if the proponents of it are, it almost... little break here. Sorry. A little break. you know, it sounds to me like there certainly were some significant concerns raised with the original bill, and I think the Department of Health is signaling that they want to be helpful, which is commendable. They certainly see the wisdom of trying to help these home care agencies get people vaccinated, but I'm still really not seeing that this, even though the Department of Health certainly prefers this solution to the other one, I kind of prefer that the proponents keep on working on their own with the department, which obviously is willing to work, and the other folks that are listed here would probably be equally willing to talk with them about a solution. So, you know, I'm not going to support this bill just as it's written unless I hear something significantly different, but that certainly doesn't mean that I'm against the underlying issue. I certainly, you know, commend the department for working with them and hope that these other folks would do so as well without any taxpayer money being allocated for them to do it.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a couple of questions. Isn't this something that is already performed by the Public Health Service or County Health Services? You know, wouldn't it be better to have it focused in say, counties and have them responsible for responding if we need to give vaccinations?
Mr. Pollack?
Chairman Schumacher and Representative Newton, thank you for that question. No, actually, public health does not perform this, or they have in the past. I should explain. They've done this in the past, and some agencies may still do it, but it's not universal. And at this point, they're losing money when they do it, and their resources are insufficient. So I think if it's an area that we want local public health to expand, it would be something that we would need to be thoughtful about and ensure that there are resources for them. It's really a question of resources in the public sector and the private sector. I mean, it's that challenge of balancing that issue. But it would be wrong to think that local public health is currently available to provide this service statewide at this point. And as I said, the ones that have continued to do it have expressed that it has been a financial loss for them.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add one other point in response to Representative Liebling's question. One of the reasons why this would have some kind of fiscal note, and obviously there's a policy committee, so we don't have those details here today, but this is the same staff that does the work on Ebola and infectious disease response that we just had the deficiency bill request about. So we wanted to be very clear that deficiency request was the money that we needed to do the work in that area, and any additional activity for that staff is going to have some cost, is going to have some fiscal note.
Thank you. Representative Newton.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and just to follow up, I would be in a comment, basically. I would be very concerned if we had the vaccines distributed to the lowest possible level because of things like expiration dates and, you know, adequate control and making sure that if they have to be refrigerated, that the vaccine is constant. So I would hope that we look at larger entities like the counties or some other agency as you move forward with this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why not have the employee just go to the doctor?
Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Chair. Some of these are pretty rural, so there again, it's the time factor, cost factor. We know how busy these people are, you know, taking care of our seniors, and for them to take a couple hours out of their day to do that, somebody's got to fill that slot, and we've already heard how thin staffed they are. So this would just help nursing facilities just be more efficient, and they are operating at a loss when they do that. So my concern is if we have the study done, maybe we could find some ways to have these vaccines properly cared for and the expiration dates, you know, addressed. So it'd be policies and procedures in place so that these more rural places, the smaller ones, could basically do it on their own instead of having to send them 30 miles, 40 miles, 50 miles to get that vaccination.
Okay, Representative Franzen. All right, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, I'm not sure if I heard the answer to my question about pharmacists. Don't pharmacists have the ability to vaccinate people? And if they do, that doesn't that kind of answer Representative Franson's question? They could just, they're pharmacists, I think, in all parts of the state, right?
Ms. Ayers.
Chairman Schumacher and Representative Liebling, yes, pharmacists do have the ability to vaccinate adults. And so they could provide the vaccines, like the hepatitis vaccine, the influenza vaccine. The challenge would be for the tuberculin. That is not technically considered a vaccine, and so I would have to check the statute to see how that would be interpreted. I'm sure that an option would be to expand that. There are definitely special skills in terms of reading that. But yes, that's something we can look into, and pharmacists do have the ability to vaccinate adults in Minnesota.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think you might have your solution right there. And if it requires a change in law to, you know, to do something around giving the tuberculin and reading it, you know, maybe that's the direction that we should think about going here. And, you know, but it certainly seems like there's something kind of almost ready-made out there.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, at least in my part of the state, a lot of the small towns are losing their pharmacy, and you know, you pretty much have to come into Mankato for a pharmacy now. I think Lake Crystal, Mapleton have all lost their pharmacists. As far as the tuberculin, I think every sheriff's department in the state has people that can read that. The custody officers are trained to do that. From unfortunately, from Blue Earth County, you know, we had somebody with tuberculosis a few years ago. But yeah, I don't believe there's that wide a spread of pharmacists around, especially in the rural areas.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions from members? Representative Newton.
Mr. Chair, again, a comment. Why wouldn't we, as a condition of employment, insist that people already have been vaccinated for all of these things? And if they have that before they're employed, we don't have to do the screening after.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Thurlow.
And Representative, I think there's a couple of things here. A number of people that we are employed are employing are potentially working poor. They may not have, prior to employment, had access to good health care such that they would have those vaccinations. They may not have the resources to go ahead and do that. I think what you're hearing here, there are a lot of complicated overlaying issues to the access of vaccines, both pre-employment and also during employment, which is one of the reasons why we think we need to bring folks together. There's a lot of intersecting laws that come into play. There's a lot of intersecting jurisdictions. And so while I think there's a lot of good ideas and a lot of things that sound simple on the surface, when you start to dig in and start to understand either there are economic reasons, there's efficiency reasons, or sort of making sure that consistently that all the vaccines are getting taken, it becomes a lot more complicated issues. With some of the I believe with the Hep vaccine, for example, it requires three doses, three times. So it's not just simply sending somebody to the doctor once; it's three times, and there are multiple things here at play. So I think while we would love to just make it as a condition of employment, we've already got issues with people not applying for the positions that we have today, and we don't want to create additional barriers. We would rather explore and see if there are other efficient, cost-effective ways of doing that and making sure that it's addressed while also protecting the health and well-being of the people that they're caring for.
Representative Newton.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Mr. Thurlow, would it be then the responsibility of the employer to pay for the vaccinations?
Ms. Thurlow.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's another topic for conversation. I think in a lot of cases the agencies do cover the vaccines. I don't know that that's universally the case. I don't know that it's required, but I think in a lot of cases they do.
Representative. Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, are there any final questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Daniels, any final comments?
Just a quick comment. I appreciate all the comments from the representatives. And I think our goal here is to help the smaller facilities who are very rural, and they don't have the opportunity to send somebody 5 minutes down the road to get their vaccination shot and come back to work. We're talking about facilities that might be 20, 30-minute drive to get their vaccination, and we've all talked, we know how short they are in staff at these facilities, so I live in Faribault, and I can probably drive 5 minutes and I can have three different pharmacies, but in some of these rural areas, it's not that convenient. So I think our goal is just to make it Well, number one, make sure we don't hurt anybody by doing the study. But most importantly, for these smaller facilities, be able to provide the vaccinations, you know, when they need it, and hopefully keep their staff in-house so they don't have to spend a half an hour, 2 hours going someplace to get that done. And I think the study would be nice just because there's so many things that intertwine. There's the expiration dates. There's the, you know, the who's going to administer it. There's just so many things that come into play. That's kind of why we have a lengthy list of people to be involved in the study. And I think that's our first step to make sure everything's safe. And that's our most important. We don't want to be endangering anybody with expired vaccines or anything like that. But just to get the study going forward so we can do this the proper way, safely, and hopefully much more efficient than we're doing it now.
All right. That was the final word, but Representative Considine?
I was just going to say I'm going to support this bill because I think getting the study done will give us a lot more of the answers that were raised here today.
All right. Thank you. With that, Representative Daniels renews his motion that House File 1152, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and House File 1152, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. Next up, members, is House File 954. And in the interest of time, since it's my bill, I'll just stay here and give the remarks, and we'll go through the bill that way. So I will move that House File 954 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform. To the bill, this bill deals with long-term care insurance and is an effort to adjust the minimum inflation protection level that the state mandates for long-term care partnership policies from 3% to 1%. Currently, about 70% of people who reach age 65, as we've heard from especially early on in the committee, 70% of people who reach age 65 are expected to need some type of long-term care. While long-term care insurance is not the silver bullet to the challenges that the silver tsunami presents to Minnesota, it is an important part of the solution. The benefits to long-term care insurance are clear. It provides a way for people to take responsibility for their long-term care and not rely on the government. It can help people preserve their home, farm, or other assets for the next generation. It alleviates the need for people to burden family members with their care, and it provides a way for people to control the kind of care that they receive, where and how it's given. To encourage people to purchase long-term care insurance, the federal government enabled the states to create a long-term care partnership, which is a public-private collaboration between long-term care insurers and the state's Medicaid programs. In Minnesota, the partnership allows residents who purchase qualified long-term care insurance policies to have more of their assets protected if they later need medical assistance to help pay for their long-term care. The idea is, of course, that those who purchase the long-term care insurance will never need to be on medical assistance. Despite the obvious benefits of long-term care insurance, the cost of the product has discouraged people from purchasing it. In a recent study, 74% of people surveyed cited that cost is the primary reason why they didn't buy long-term care insurance. The goal of this bill is to make long-term care insurance more affordable for middle-income people that need it the most. It does this by allowing the partnership policies to be sold with lower levels of inflation protection, and that inflation protection rider allows for the benefits to keep pace with the cost of care. House File 954 is supported by the Department of Commerce and was one of the recommendations of Governor Dayton's On Your Future advisory panel. And with that, I welcome Robin Rowan to testify and give more information and answer any of your questions. Ms. Rowan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. I'm kind of lonely at this table. It's a good bill if someone wants to just come and hang out with me for a few minutes, for a very short few minutes. As the chair said, I'm Robin Rowan. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, or MFSI. MFSI members provide financial security through the sale of life insurance, long-term care insurance, annuities, and retirement products like 401ks and 529s. MFSI members also support 65,000 jobs in Minnesota, and that includes the agents that distribute our products all across the state. Current law requires that in a partnership, in order to be qualified as a partnership policy, the policy must have a 3% inflation protection rider, and what we are proposing is to change that to 1%. What we've discovered since the inception of the partnership program in Minnesota is that, one, people who buy long-term care want it to be a partnership policy, and two, through market research, we've discovered that the cost of the 3% inflation protection rider was pricing middle-income folks out of the long-term care insurance market. And the middle-income folks, as the chair said, are exactly the folks that would benefit the most from long-term care. For example, what we discovered is that for a 55-year-old couple that purchased a partnership policy with an initial benefit pool of $185,000, the premium for them would be approximately $348 a month, but with a 1% inflation protection rider, that couple would save over $100 a month and over $1,400 a year. And that's very meaningful savings for people who want to buy the product. What we've also discovered with the 3% inflation protection rider is that people are buying more coverage than they need or that they're using. Genworth, which is the largest long-term care rider in the country, did a study that showed that people were only using 67% of the benefit that they were purchasing, meaning they were paying way too much for their policies. So, and part of the reason for this is the advent of home care, is that more people, policyholders, want to have care in their homes and stay in their homes as long as possible. And home care is less expensive than nursing home care, and in addition, it's growing at less than 1% per year. So a policy with 1% inflation protection would provide very meaningful coverage for someone who wanted to purchase the long-term care policy. As the chair said, this was, it's a recommendation of the Own Your Future Task Force, which is Governor Dayton's task force to encourage people to take responsibility for their long-term care needs, and it's also supported by the Department of Commerce. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I will move to member questions. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony, and thank you for coming to talk to me in my office about this, so I got a little bit of a heads up about what this is about. I really appreciate that. It's very helpful, especially on something like this that's really kind of complicated, even though the bill itself is extremely simple.
One change.
Right? Yes. But the question is, since this is intended to help people purchase, to hold the cost down, and help people purchase long-term care insurance, could we build in, the bill's very simple, but could we build in, and maybe this is more for the chair, some kind of outcome measure? Because we're doing a significant change here, and I realize that some of this we won't know for many decades what the impact is, but we will know pretty soon if it really increases the number of people who can buy long-term care insurance, and so something like this, I'd really like to see us build in some kind of mechanism to revisit it and evaluate it. And so if you could do that, I would vote for this bill today, but it would be great if by the time it gets through the process it would have something like that on it. I don't think it would be that hard to do. Maybe the testifier could tell us how hard that would be or not, so that we could really see if this is something that works.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Ms. Rowan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, we've seen in other states where they have 1% inflation protection policy, 1% inflation protection riders, that it has in fact increased the number of people that have purchased the policy. Speaking for my organization, we would not have a problem coming back and reporting on what we've seen. My organization doesn't represent the entire long-term care insurance market. It might be something that the Department of Commerce would be better able to report on if you wanted the entire marketplace.
Yeah.
Thank you, and I would be open to working on that as well as it goes through the process, Representative Liebling.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would appreciate that. And, you know, obviously, Ms. Rowan can't do it, but, you know, to have Commerce or somebody else, and I think if we're doing that, we would probably want to think about the other ways that we could perhaps evaluate the impact of this. And since it does intersect with medical assistance, it would be great if there, I don't even know if it's possible, but if there could be some projections about, you know, as people buy or don't buy these more policies, and because it intersects with that and, you know, all the stuff that I don't have a really good grasp of, but you probably do, and, you know, how we can really evaluate this more on more dimensions, as many dimensions as possible, because, you know, I love what you said in the beginning about it's a silver tsunami and we don't have a silver bullet. You know, so that's certainly true.
Coming out right there.
But we certainly need to figure out whether our so-called bullets are, you know, silver, gold, or bronze, you know. So it would be great. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can understand why in the current economic situation why the 1% would be more appropriate than the 3%, but I can also foresee us having to come back again and again and again to tweak that percent as inflation changes, as interest rate changes. And I'm wondering if there's some way we could instead tie it to the prime rate or the inflation rate or something like that, at the risk of complicating things for the consumers understanding the product. But, you know, right now interest rates are ridiculously low. And inflation hasn't taken off, but we've certainly been in other circumstances in the past. So I just wouldn't like to have to keep revisiting this and changing it repeatedly. If we could somehow figure out a way to fix it for good.
Thank you, Ms. Rowan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Yaruso, consumers would still have the opportunity that have the policy to change their inflation protection riders throughout the course of the policy. In addition to that, there is the ability to have a consumer price index attached to your inflation protection rider. But what we have found in the marketplace is that consumers are uncomfortable with that, as were regulators, because they don't know where it's going to be. People were much more comfortable when they could count on knowing what the inflation protection level is and then knowing what their benefit pool would be with a single level of inflation protection throughout the policy.
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, but the purpose of the beginning of line 2.10 is to set a floor, not to determine what the additional options might be. And so, you know, the question is, what's the appropriate floor? You know, and if the floor doesn't have something to do with reality, then I don't know why we have a floor. So I was assuming that the percent we would choose for the floor would have something to do with a reasonable balance between the cost for the insurers and the protection the person might need and whatnot. So I'm just curious why we would have the 1% at all if it doesn't relate somehow to the changing circumstances. If we find ourselves in a high inflation period and a high interest rate period, that's not going to be a very appropriate floor.
Ms. Rowan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Yaruso, 1%, we had talked about not putting any floor, but we were not comfortable with people buying policies that didn't have any inflation protection riders at all. And plus, when you're purchasing it, you still have the ability to buy 2, 3, 4, and 5% inflation protection. So the options when you buy it, taking circumstances into account, which agents are required to do before they can recommend any policy, will take into account what the appropriate level of inflation protection might be. In addition, if you've had the policy 15 years and you think you need to increase your inflation protection level, you have that option as well.
Follow-up, Representative Yaruso?
Just a comment. I'm not talking about options. I'm talking about floor. So the question is, how do we set that floor in a way that doesn't make the legislature have to come back every time the prime interest rate changes or inflation rate changes? So it's not about everybody having the option to do something different as they go along. It's about the fact that we've got regulations for this, and if there's going to be a floor, it should be meaningful. That's all.
Thank you, Representative Yaruso. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Cost would not be the thing that would deter me from buying long-term care insurance. It would be the experience I had while my mother was in Cottagewood, which bills itself as a memory unit. Everybody in there has dementia or Alzheimer's. However, Bob Meyer, who is the county administrator in Blue Earth County, his mother was my mother's roommate. His father was in insurance, and they had long-term care. His father thought they had it all taken care of. And once they got there, they were denied coverage. And I actually saw that several times where, you know, they got into the facility, and then some nuance in the licensing or something, the coverage was denied. And I would be real hesitant to put that kind of money into a policy that I wasn't sure was actually going to pay off. And I don't claim to be an expert. It's a very narrow anecdotal reference that I have, but what I did see on a couple of different occasions was people that came in and thought they had everything covered, and it turned out they didn't.
Thank you. Ms. Rowan.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Considine, I'd be very interested to talk with you about more about the circumstances involved in that case. I can tell you that the policies that were issued much earlier, near the beginning of when the product first came to market, were far narrower than they are now. The regulators stepped up nationally and passed some very strict laws about what conditions need to be present in order to deny coverage, and have expanded coverage significantly. For example, policies a long time ago used to require a 3-day hospital stay before you could start your nursing home care. Those policies are against the law now. So there have been a huge number of improvements, and yesterday's policies are not today's policies. But I would love to talk with you about the circumstances and see if that's covered in today's regulation. I'm hopeful that it is.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gunther.
Well, I look at what Representative Yarusa was stating. I think about all the things that could change the floor and the cost escalation, such as state and federal regulations. I look at there are much more than consumer price index can cover, because they don't cover state changes the way we have. Staffing changes, minimum wage changes, they all affect how much a nursing home cost will stay will be. And so it should be changed, or we don't make any new laws, one or the other.
Ms. Rowan, anything to that point?
Mr. Chair, Representative, what we have found is that when this product initially came to market, it was required, and we still are required, in fact, to offer a 5% inflation protection rider to cover any possible fluctuation in the marketplace, but people couldn't afford it, and people weren't buying it. And so this provides additional flexibility to buy some inflation protection and still get the coverage. You can change it if market conditions change. But at the same time, we also feel that some coverage is better than no coverage at all. And so providing maximum flexibility in the level of the inflation protection is what seems to make sense.
All right. Are there any final questions for the testifier? Seeing none, and I have no final comments, so I will renew my motion that House File 954 be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and House File 954 is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform. Thank you. Next up today, we have House File 805 with Representative Joachim. I will move House File 805 be recommended to be re-referred to Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. We have the bill before us, and there is an author's amendment titled A3. I will move the author's amendment. Representative Joachim, when you are ready, to your amendment.
I like you more and more.
Hello, members. Chair, thank you so much for hearing my bill today. Per tradition, even though I have had a bill up in another committee, I did bring homemade cookies for you to enjoy. Hopefully you like them. It's a family recipe. So I do have an amendment. Chair, I don't know if you want me to do some brief description of the bill and then walk through the amendment, or what's your pleasure?
Representative Joachim, if you want to just tell us what the amendment does quick, we'll adopt that, get the bill in the form you want it, and then do the walkthrough.
Basically, the amendment's just doing some clarifying language. Once I started working, first I worked with the BCA, and then I started working with the stakeholders for the working group. Had to change some names, took some suggestions from the BCA on limiting the membership, and structured a little bit better so it was more understandable, and also added a sunset to it. So once the working group presents their findings, the working group can sunset, because it's always nice to have things completed and wrapped up instead of having working groups floating out there. So that's basically what the amendment does.
Okay, and Representative Joachim, it looks like we didn't have the amendment put in the packet. So if you want to do your walkthrough, I apologize. We'll get that fixed.
I'll quick brief explain the bill then. And
if you would, please. Thank you.
Okay, wonderful. So I brought this bill before the committee. As many members know, many of us bring bills before the committee that are really personal to us or things that are born from experiences that we've had. My grandmother, who's now gone, had Alzheimer's the last few years of her life. So she was, at the time, she was a widow living in her home by herself, and her children are sharing the task of taking care of her. And I know that my story is not unique. I know there's probably many people around the table that have had this similar experience of caregiving in a family member's house that's trying to age in place. And I know this is something with our changing demographics that's going to happen more and more often as we move forward. My mother and her siblings were able to afford part-time care, and they divided up the rest of the caregiving, but there was always this worry or concern that she might wander off why someone wasn't watching or when there was a gap in coverage. And she lived in North St. Paul, just a block up from Lake Phelan, so the water was a concern, as was the Minnesota winters. So I had first heard of this bill from a fellow colleague, actually, last year, and started working on what it might look like. And this bill is patterned after an Amber Alert, where they'd be able to get information out quickly to law enforcement and the public if there's a missing vulnerable adult. Through my experience with my grandmother and my grandfather, who had dementia at the end of his life as well, I really have become more familiar with the issue and silver alerts that other states have, and would like to see how this would fit in the resources that we have currently in Minnesota. And that's where I started back in January. I sat down with the BCA and Janelle Rasmussen, who is the Director of Criminal Justice Training and Education at the BCA, to see what programs we already had in place, what was missing, and how best to approach the issue. Mrs. Rasmussen, who's here in the audience to answer questions, has extensive experience on setting national criteria, and she also administers the programs we have here in the state between our Amber Alert and our Emergency Action Network. And I thought the best approach would be to actually go to those experts and those stakeholders and ask them, how do you think this would fit in Minnesota? How do you think it would work? What criteria would be put into place instead of spending money and just telling them, do a silver alert? So that's where the thought of the working group was born. In your package, you have a letter from the Alzheimer's Association in support of the bill. And I have Heidi Haley Franklin here, the Vice President of Clinical Services with the Alzheimer's Association, who can give brief testimony on wandering and the issues out there with that. And I, like you said, I also have the A3 amendment. So if you want, do you have that now? Do you want me to walk through it line by line?
Oh, we do not have that yet. Okay. So if we could move to the testimony from Ms. Franklin,
that'd
be great.
I'm sorry about that. It was posted online, so I thought you guys would have it. So page one, there's just a semicolon deleted and 80 in line 1.5. On page 1.6, after the word required, we inserted duties because it would just make sense to let them know what they're supposed to be doing. On page 1, line 7, after the first A, we insert the silver alert system, just another clarifying change to be more specific. On page 1, line 16, we struck lines 17 through 22 because it was a little confusing about who the members of the working group were. There was a few names that were wrong. There was a working group that, an organization that no longer exists because it was put in place with the Tubman Association. And I also wanted to make sure that the BCA would reach out to members of the diverse community to see how they would like to approach an Alzheimer's alert. So on the amendment that you hopefully will be getting soon, lines 1.8 through 1.25 of the amendment just clarifies the stakeholders in the working group, how many numbers there can be, and then also allows the commissioner of the Department of Transportation to appoint who they want in the working group, and brings in one person from the Cultural and Ethical Communities Leadership Council, too, to bring about that diversity. On the amendment on line 1, page 1, line 23, after commissioner, we add public safety, another clarification of which commissioner we're talking about. On line 1, on page 1, line 24, we change September to August for the start of the working group, so it would give them just a little bit longer time before they had to bring the report back in January. And on page 2, on line 9, is where we inserted the sunset clause that reads, the working group expires the day after submitting the report required under Subdivision 4 or February 15th, 2016, whichever is earlier. And like I said before, the reason why I went the working group alternative is I didn't want to just tell the BCA to create a silver alert if we had things in place that we're already doing what the intent was. And the intent of this bill is to make sure that people with Alzheimer's, traumatic brain injury, dementia, if they wander away, the word can get out quickly, because as you know, in Minnesota, minutes can definitely matter, especially when it's 30 below. So I have Heidi Haley here, Franklin here, to testify.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Franklin. If you could please state your name for the record and offer us your testimony.
Sure. Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Heidi Haley Franklin. I'm the Vice President of Clinical Services with the Alzheimer's Association. And the Alzheimer's Association is the world's leading health organization in Alzheimer's care, support, and research. I would like to express our strong support for House File 805 to create a working group to thoughtfully determine the need for a silver alert system in Minnesota. Currently, there are an estimated 100,000 Minnesotans living with Alzheimer's disease and an additional 245,000 family caregivers who are providing care and support every day to those touched by dementia. With age being the greatest risk factor for Alzheimer's, this number is set to skyrocket. And Alzheimer's is a public health crisis and the defining disease of the baby boom generation. The reality is that 6 out of 10 individuals with Alzheimer's or dementia will wander at some point in the disease process, and many will wander repeatedly. Caregivers may expect symptoms of severe memory loss and confusion, but oftentimes they are not prepared to be on a constant heightened state of alert to monitor the whereabouts of their family members with dementia. These family caregivers never know when wandering will take place. However, they do know that it can be dangerous and oftentimes life-threatening. If individuals with dementia are not found within 24 hours, up to 50% of the 50% will suffer serious injury or death. And in addition, a person with memory loss may not be able to provide their name, phone number, or address to the person who finds them and may not even appear to know that they're lost. Even if they're located, reuniting them with a family member presents challenges. Wandering is a common symptom of dementia, and it poses constant stress, which weighs heavily on caregivers and their family members. And these wandering incidents must be treated as an emergency, and the response must begin immediately. As you can imagine, it can only take a moment for someone with dementia to wander away. And it's true in any setting, whether they're at home, at the grocery store, in the mall. And although most individuals who wander can be located within a mile and a half of their home, living in greater Minnesota poses many unique challenges, which I'm aware that many of you are from greater Minnesota and are aware of those challenges. Certainly social isolation and a vast geography contribute to even more significant safety concerns. A person with dementia could wander a few miles down a road or through a field, and they may not see a friendly neighbor face to help them get reunited with their family member. Additionally, in more rural areas of Minnesota, technologies such as GPS tracking systems can be reliable. They may not always function properly, which creates even more of a challenge to keep Minnesotans with dementia safe. Wandering is not limited to community settings either. It certainly occurs in assisted living facilities, nursing homes, and memory care facilities, which creates even a greater urgency for immediate action to take place. Age is the strongest factor in predicting Alzheimer's disease, with 1 in 3 individuals impacted by the disease at age 85. And as the baby boomer population continues to age, the number of individuals with potential to wander will grow dramatically. I'd be happy to take questions from this committee, but I do urge the committee move forward in this very important piece of legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Franklin. We do have a couple of questions for you. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's kind of more of, I don't know, maybe there'll end up being a question in this, but it's mostly comment. I'm not certain really why we need to do a study to determine the need. It seems pretty clear that there's at least some need. And we already have an existing system, and it would be relatively easy, I would think, to expand the existing system to also cover vulnerable adults, for which we already have working definitions in statute, which would also cover not only people that have memory problems and tend to wander, but there's, you know, some elderly adults with health conditions that if they don't return in a reasonable time would be an issue. And, you know, to make the bold suggestion, let's just do it. Let's just put it on there and then put a request for a report back from the BCA on the extent to which it was used for vulnerable adults. And if there's no need, that will cause no cost. And if there's a great need, we will have accomplished something. So that would be my suggestion. I don't really see going off and studying it for a long time when we know we have people with Alzheimer's. We know we have people that wander. I shared a story with Representative Newton a little while ago. It's not a totally new thing. It's just going to have an increasing incidence. My mother rescued somebody in our neighborhood once that had wandered away from Crestview in Columbia Heights. So let's just do it. I'd love to see it come back as just like just add it to it and get it done.
Thank you, Representative Yaruso. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And my comment's a little different. First of all, thank you so much for working on this, Representative Joachim. I think it's obviously a really important issue. When Representative Norton was here earlier with her bill, there were a lot of comments from the committee about how critical an issue this really is. So thank you. I have a couple comments. First of all, on the amendment, I'm kind of wondering why the Commissioner of Human Services is not involved. And I would just urge you, as the bill moves forward, to think about, you know, adding that, because you've got a lot of people here that are with public safety. You've got the ethnic piece, which is appointed by the Commissioner of Human Services, but there's nobody here that I see that really represents that caregiving, you know, from the point of view of the state, the healthcare community or the long-term care community. So I would just urge you to think about adding that. Also, I actually think in this case a working group is a good idea. I see there's no appropriation with the bill, which I don't think you need one. But I think I'd like to see the group think about how to coordinate this with the kind of alert system that Representative Norton was talking about, which is different than what you're talking about here. But we just passed off the floor a blue alert for law enforcement issues. And I just want to know how all this stuff fits together. And it's great that members are coming forward with these ideas and the desire to do this. And I think we all share that. But that's why I think in this case, having a working group, if it's broad enough and it looks at all these different things, both what we might have in law already and how we might expand that, get it all to work the best so that we don't include too much, so that people just, you know, don't pay it. Oh, it's another one of those alerts. You know, we don't want that to happen. On the other hand, you know, maybe dealing with dementias and people, maybe there's a better way to deal with this, like through the kind of alert system that Representative Norton brought to us. So I think it's really a good idea to look at all of that broadly, because there's a clear need for this, and I think it's really clear that it would save untold human misery and a lot of costs for the state to have a really good, effective system. So thank you.
Representative Joachim.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, you kind of hit the nail on the head, and that's why I did the approach with the working group and sat down with the BCA, because I know with the implementation of Brandon's Law and with the Emergency Action Network that's already there, and knowing of Representative Cornish's intent with the Blue Alert, I too wanted to make sure that we weren't just putting a random alert in place and spending money on it if we didn't need it. Others, when I asked Mrs. Rasmussen, I hope she'll be able to come up here too and answer any technical questions, about silver alerts that were in other states. She said there is no, like, set. Amber alerts have a set national criteria that was worked on really hard to make sure that you don't have that overuse of the system to the point where people go, oh, just another one of those, and stop paying attention to them. So I wanted to make sure that if this was put in place, that was very effective, that there were set criteria so that that didn't happen. And I'm more than happy to have it, them look at everything that's in place right now and figure out how it would fit. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Joachim. And we are coming close to the end of our meeting time. I do want to make sure that the other testifier comes in. I do have Representative Miller, Mason, and Rosenthal on the list. I'd like to hear from the other testifier and then take questions if that's okay. Or is this to the current testifier? It's okay? Okay. Ms. Rasmussen, you could please come forward. And
Mr. Chair, I just want to also, I was remiss in not thanking the co-authors that I have on this committee, Representative Baker, Representative Considine, Representative U. Russo. So thank you very much for your support.
Thank you. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your brief testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Janelle Rasmussen. I am the statewide Amber Alert Coordinator at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And Representative Joachim approached the BCA about this bill to ask about what we're currently doing in Minnesota with Silver Alerts. So I just wanted to give you a very quick overview of what we do right now in the state of Minnesota for cases that would meet a similar criteria to a Silver Alert here in our state. We have the Minnesota Crime Alert Network, which is a broadcast system where we're able to notify the entire state of Minnesota on anyone who is missing or in danger through our broadcast fax and email technology, which goes to the media, law enforcement, and all of our partners. What this bill does is gives us an opportunity to work with these specific groups to look at what we're doing in Minnesota. Is there room to make changes, or is the system that we currently have in place adequate? There are 20 other states in the U.S. that have silver alert plans with a very strict set of criteria, and 15 other states, which includes Minnesota, that have plans that offer a system that is similar but not as specifically called a silver alert plan. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll go back to member questions. Representative Mason.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And basically, I think my question has been already covered. But the Blue Alert, when we ask questions about expanding it, the thought is if you get too many. And so I guess my question is, how many people do you think per day or per week would you be putting into the Silver Alert broadcast system?
Ms. Rasmussen or... Yep.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, one of the things that we did with the Amber Alert system is we went back before we started the plan and looked at how many cases we would have had that would have met that criteria. We found really the Jacob Wetterling case would have been probably the only case we thought that would have met that criteria. After we started the Amber Alert plan, we found that there were others that came up during that time that we just didn't have reported. So it depends on the amount of cases that we would have reported in through the system. It also depends on the criteria that is established through this working group if we did find the need for a system like this. So based on the criteria that we have, we set that up very strictly, and in Minnesota, you know, we very rarely use the Amber Alert plan here. In fact, we haven't had an Amber Alert activation in over a year here. So we follow that criteria to make sure that we don't overuse the system and the program becomes ineffective here.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and part of my question has been answered by Representatives Liebling and Mason, so I think I'll just have a brief comment. And having dealt with this personally in my family, it's a big issue. when we moved into our current home, we were woken up one morning at 1 o'clock in the morning, and there was an older woman in a nightgown and no shoes on and 5 inches of snow. And we took her into our house, sat her down, got her warmed up, and called the police. And they instantly knew who she was and where she belonged. But she's not alone, and thankfully she came to a house that was safe, and we would hope that everybody comes to a house or a place that was safe. So thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. Representative Considine.
It's kind of been... Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. But when this came to public safety, that was actually some of the questions I asked. And again, the Amber Alert has been rarely used. I was very concerned about overtaxing the system. And again, the number of times that a police officer gets shot or injured is, you know, thank goodness, rather low. So I don't believe with those other two that we're really going to be overtaxing the system. The only other thing I would add is that, yeah, it's amazing how people, again, from the facility my mother was in, there was a woman that was had been an administrator, and she would talk to people and actually just walk out with them because they thought she worked there, and then she would get lost. So I think it's a great idea. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Considine. Are there any other questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Iwakim, final words, and then we'll adopt your amendment and pass your bill.
I just again want to thank you. Obviously, it's a kind of a labor of love for me with my family circumstances, but I know I'm not unique. Like I said, there's many of you that have the same stories around the table, and I look forward to going through the process. I understand it's going to GovOps next, and I'm assuming it'll have to make a stop in public safety with Representative Cornish. It does have a Senate file that passed through all the committees, or sorry, the other body has put it on their general order. Shouldn't use that word, right? But no, so I appreciate you moving this bill forward. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And with that, I'll renew my motion to adopt the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted, and I will renew my motion that House File 805 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and House File 805 as amended is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Operations and Elections Policies. Members, we have about 20 seconds, but the next bill is pretty much similar to what we've seen already today from Representative Christensen, who is going to be moving House File 1615 to be recommended to be re-referred also to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. We have the bill before us. Representative Christensen, to your bill, briefly.
Mr. Chair, we've heard a lot of testimony about this is kind of a combination with a couple of changes of the Joaquin bill and the Norton bill. I think it provides us more options for how best to address this issue, and it adopts a Representative Yarusso's suggestion to just go ahead and do the silver alert. Hopefully we can help some.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on this? Seeing none, Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And I at first thought this was just an absolute clone of these two bills. I'm glad to hear that it isn't, because I think that that's really... obviously, the two authors who testified on these have done a lot of work on these issues, and I think that for a member to simply clone somebody else's bill, perhaps because they're in the opposite party or perhaps for some other reason, really would not be, I think it would be just a matter of plagiarism. So I'm glad to hear Representative Christensen say that there are changes that he made, and I'd like to hear more about the differences. I didn't quite understand in that quick explanation what the differences are, and so if these are not exactly the same bills, you know, put together, I'd like to know in a little more detail what the differences are.
Representative Christensen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, one of the main differences is that it adopts Representative Yarusso's suggestion to, instead of just a working group, to consider a silver alert. It does establish a silver alert.
Representative Liebling?
Well, and so, Mr. Chair, I take it that's the only difference, that it establishes a silver alert instead of a working group?
Representative Liebling, my understanding is it also is a little bit more narrow, especially in the provisions that Representative Norton had, more narrow in the scope of what it would cover within that as well, just dealing only with people over the age of 65 with the Silver Alert, where Representative Norton's expanded it to some of the things that the testifiers that she had were wanting to address.
Well, Mr. Chair, that being the case, I guess I don't see the point of passing this bill. I don't think we should just be establishing the Silver Alert. I, in fact, think that the method that was laid out by Representative Joachim is, in fact, the way to go, and that we should study it, not just establish it. I don't see the point of going forward with this separately, combining these, other than, you know, if you want to have a Republican member being the author. But obviously, as I said before, these two other authors did a great deal of work on this over a long period of time. And so, you know, I am going to vote no on this bill, and I'd like a roll call on it.
Okay, a roll call having been requested. Representative Considine. And we are 8 minutes over, Representative Considine. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but I want to make sure I heard you correctly. So this bill would eliminate the kids with autism?
Representative Considine, the scope is narrowed in this bill.
So it would eliminate the kids with autism?
Right, right, along with the silver concept and silver alert.
Mr. Chair, you're asking us to throw out a quick vote, and there's suddenly a lot of conversation going on here. This may be inappropriate, but I ask to be held over then if we're going to have a vote on this.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'd make a motion to lay this bill on the table and ask for a roll call on that, so that, and just for members who are new, you know, you can vote to lay it on the table. It can be taken up at a later time. It doesn't kill the bill. We could vote again to take it up again, to move it on at another time, but that would kind of deal with the issue right now.
Okay.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. The motion before us is to table House File 1615. Members, is a non-debatable motion. Also, and a roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll.
Schumacher?
Yes.
Tice?
Yes.
Lilly?
Yes.
Baker?
Yes.
Christensen?
Yes.
Considine?
Yes.
Daniels?
Yes.
Franzen?
Yes.
Gunther?
Yes.
Keel?
Yes.
Liebling?
Yes.
Mason?
Yes.
Miller?
Yes.
Newton? Rosenthal?
Yes.
Urusso?
Yes.
Okay, there being 16 ayes and 0 nays, the bill has been tabled. We are adjourned.